love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins is brought to you by Sherry's Berries, Pro Flowers, and Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/undisclosed. Also, the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. Enjoy the program.
Dee Watkins here with Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. I got an amazing panel today. I'm joined by my co-host, Justine Barron. Justine is a political and nonprofit consultant and a film and TV writer. I also have Kandwani Fidel, award-winning spoken word artist and author of Raw Wounds. Check his book out. It's really good. And Kwame Rose. Kwame is a social activist, artist, and contributor for USA Today. How you guys doing?
Good, man. Thank you for having me.
Hey, so today's going to be a really, really, really great show. As you heard Justine on the podcast, talk about a number of things that I can't wait to talk about, from Baltimore Sun reporting to a history of Commissioner Batts. But then we also have Kandwani and Kwame, who both have a different type of proximity to this issue. You know, once Freddie Gray actually died, you know, these two young men, you know, they took to the streets, and this was their first real experience in participating in any form of activism. Correct me if I'm wrong, but this, you know, it lit a fire in both of these young men. A lot of you guys might remember Kwame Rose from the viral video where he was, his name's Geraldo, I like to call him Geraldo, but he was fussing with Geraldo. And Kandwani, he was a poet, but he dug deep into his soul and started pulling poems out that spoke to the voices of people like Freddie Gray. And, you know, I think it was a magical experience for the city, for these young people to step up and for their lives to be transformed. So let's start with you, Kwame. Take us back to when you first heard about what happened to Freddie Gray. I know you were working at a hotel, you know, this wasn't a world that you thought you would be a part of.
Yeah. I mean, when I first heard of Freddie Gray, I was at work scrolling on a computer, and I seen black man injured in police custody. That was like maybe the 13th or the 14th of April 2015. And then a couple of days later, it said that he died. So, you know, working downtown on my way to work, because I was living downtown at the moment, I would start seeing, you know, a couple people gather with signs throughout, whether it's not around my neighborhood or downtown at the harbor. And then as time went on, and like the less response we got and the less transparency, you know, information that trickled down from City Hall and the police department, more people just got angry and upset. And I think what happened, you saw a lot of like the lid was taken off of the trash can of lives like most people in Baltimore City have been experiencing, and the pain and suffering just spewed out for like 2 weeks. It's one of the most beautiful things I had ever seen from a community standpoint. But when you think about it, like 2 years later, you know, I've been asking myself this whole week, you know, what like really did that affect? What change did we make, you know, that has a long lasting impact?
Mm. And Kandwani, you were just coming out of college.
Yeah, I was actually graduating. I was in the process of graduating. And my first time ever getting involved in caring about police brutality was the Argonne situation, because I heard about it. And, you know, black people, we also, you know, concern racist ideas and believe racist ideas. So when I heard about it, I said, oh, what did he do? Just, you know, jumping to the conclusion that every time a police officer beat somebody up or murder somebody, the black person did something, right? So then I seen a video, and this was like my first time getting emotionally attached to this struggle, you know, and I devoted myself to it, you know, then. And then when the Freddie Gray situation happened, I just kept seeing posts on my social media that just said Freddie Gray with nothing else. They just was like posting a name, and I was like, you know, I would scroll past it because I'm like, you know, whatever. And then a few days later, I started reading articles saying how this dude from Baltimore, you know, died in police custody. And I immediately went home, and I just went to just talk to some people in my neighborhood, because a lot of people, they look up to me, you know, because I'm like one of the only people who went to college in my neighborhood and, you know, things of that nature. So I just went back and talked to them, you know, just to make sure that they were, you know, doing well, and just trying to make the, you know, the best out of these situations, and trying to get them to understand systemic oppression and systemic racism, and, you know, how all of these things, you know, are set up. Like, people like Freddie Gray are supposed to get murdered by, you know, gangs like the Baltimore City Police Department. So I was just trying to get them to understand that, and I just devote my work, you know, part of my work to that.
So calling them gangs is a great intro for you, Justine. I think we should probably start with this whole idea of the black police officer, or the role of the black police officer in the black neighborhood. And maybe you can speak to some of the things that you broke down in the episode.
Okay, so we have leadership here. We have a black commissioner. We have a black state's attorney. We have a black mayor. And I remember, I think the mayor at one point made a speech like, well, if three black women, and I think she was talking about herself, Mosby, and the DOJ representative, I believe, if we can't get to the bottom of what happened here, then nobody can. And, you know, they failed anyway. And so it is interesting when we look at that, to think that representation is enough when the system is so much more complicated than that. And, you know, in talking to people about Commissioner Batts that knew him very, very well in Long Beach, I mean, this is a little touchy, but one of the things that a few people said was that he had a lot of black officers that were allies of his. And then when he became command level, which is like what we call a deputy commissioner here, they call a commander there, he sort of turned his back on them, and he was focused more on the politicians. And I heard the same thing in Baltimore. He was focused on the politicians and the optics. And here the politicians were black, but that's where it kind of, at that level, I don't want to say it completely evens out, but it kind of evens out. I mean, if I were African American of Baltimore looking to these leaders, to be honest with me, accountable, I would be highly disappointed.
When I look at him, when I see him talk, or, you know, I don't know him personally, but when I saw like some of the, you know, the press conferences and things like that, and guys, feel free to jump in, I didn't really see a black person, though. I saw just like there's no feeling or no passion. Like I would hear him speak and I'm like, yo, this guy just doesn't care about anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk about the point of like representation, like having these black bodies in position of power, and somehow that mythologically erases all of the racial history or the racial prejudices that these institutions have, I think that's what they want us to believe. If you look at Baltimore on a larger scale, it's the perfect example of white supremacy being ran by black faces and black bodies. You know, what took place after the uprising happened, or after the CVS burnt, wasn't about justice, or wasn't about community calming. It was more about community control, you know, where these black people in positions of power were literally pandering to the fear of whiteness and white supremacy and white people that lived in the city trying to control black people who've been living in poverty.
But what's your impression of Batts? What's your impression of him? I know you saw, you know, the black guy with the bald head. I know you saw him before.
I would say, honestly, you know, growing up, you know, I never knew anything about politics. Me, my friends, my family, we just probably knew who the mayor was. That's it. We don't even know who run our district. So when you start throwing the words around like leaders, they was never leaders to me or any of my friends because we didn't even know them, right? Our leaders were rap artists, basketball players, you know, NFL players, and the 12 o'clock boys that ride dirt bikes. That was our leaders, right? So I just feel like it's a different black America in in Baltimore. You get what I'm saying? And I see it now because I'm on a, you know, side of the spectrum where people talking about politics and we using words like racism and oppression and policy. But then I got an 18-year-old little brother and all of his friends and, you know, their little homeboys, they don't know anything about these terms. They don't know anything about what's going on. So,
you know, we know the mayor, but we also know the state's attorneys. We know who those prosecutors are. Like, we know certain prosecutors, and we also know certain judges who we want to go in front of and who we don't want to go in front of. But you're right. We don't know the police commissioner. We don't know who the lieutenant and the captain is. And we really don't know the cops. And stuff for them. And we're going to talk about this because Justine did a great job talking about this in the episode. But we know about the knockers. Certain knockers were like notorious. They had like names that rang bells. Like, yo, when something come around, he's gonna spit on your front. He's gonna call your grandmother a B. He's gonna take his boot and jam it in the back of your neck. Like, we know that.
Like, it was this one officer called Simmons, and nobody played with Simmons. I think he broke like a couple dudes' legs. Like, for real, you know, he had beat him up, and that's the thing. They're like, yo, don't get caught by Simmons.
Don't get caught by Simmons. Don't get caught by him.
I'm telling you, and he was fast. He was built like Ray Rice. Like, he was fast, stocky. Like, he really used to chase dudes down and really beat them up. Like, that was a goal. Like, yo, like, get away from Simmons if he come around, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting when you say we don't know anything about police. I think especially for someone like Anthony Batts, who moved from city to city, was, you know, by all accounts, very corrupt. You won't find any defenders. I don't worry. You know, I don't worry anyway because we have to tell the truth. But like, I especially don't worry about what I say about Anthony Batts because he is not liked anywhere. He went from city to city, and because of sort of the cloak of secrecy around policing, I mean, where do you find out how the police department works? You have to hunt online and look for people who might have uploaded things to Document Cloud because they wanted it out there. It's all very secretive. And so one of Batts' tragic flaws, which was, you know, helpful for us, is that he couldn't keep his mouth shut. And when the national media descended on Baltimore, he was just in front of the camera all the time, making an ass out of himself and double speaking and saying this and then saying that, making up lies about gangs. But in a way, if it weren't for that, we still wouldn't know. And the catharsis that hasn't happened around Freddie Gray yet, which is only going to happen when the truth is fully revealed, like, that would have been even deeper and darker if it kind of weren't for the media hogging that he was doing, you know?
I don't think it's just on Batts when it comes to that. I think, you know, like, when this incident first happened, you had a black police commissioner, a black mayor, and a black state's attorney. But all three of them were so far removed from the black community in Baltimore City that was actually being affected by these issues that they really had no idea of what to say or how to relate or what actually was happening. One of the first, like, powerful figures in Baltimore I met with after the uprising, Batts actually called me into his office and like was asking for people to help, you know, like save his job. He literally said, I'm losing my job. The officers turned their back on me. Like, can you and the rest of the community activists like support me? And my response was like, nigga, I don't know you. Like, I didn't even know who you was until this happened.
But you see how he would call you. He would never, ever, ever think about calling me. Like, he wouldn't even think about it. It wouldn't even cross his mind. So
we
that's
like
even like a strategic
it.
Move.
Yeah.
Like, yo, he's young.
Yeah.
He's fresh. He's mm-hmm. new. He yep. did well against Geraldo. Like, we want to talk to him. We don't want to talk to this old jaded.
Yeah, but that's what the city do. They pick like certain individuals who they think can like take over the realms of power when they're out.
But you didn't take the bait.
Nah, it wasn't about that for me. Like, for a lot of people, we wasn't out there just to like have a pacifying solution. We really were out there thinking that the streets would be filled with protests for weeks and weeks at a time. And then the more reality hit, like, damn, ain't nothing about to change.
Yo, because some of them protesters had to go to work.
Yeah,
it was like, yo, like, your sick time is gone. You want to eat? Or
luckily
you
enough, I got suspended from work, so I had 2 weeks free anyway.
And another thing, like with the protests, you know, it definitely opened my eyes to a lot. You know, because it was at one point where I thought that, you know, protesting was the end all be all. Because mind you, mm-hmm. I'm just getting into this stuff and I'm just doing what I see people do. You know, I'm not, you know, reading about it or I'm not fully understanding it. But then, you know, after a couple of protests, you realize that this all some people really do is just protest. And I'm like, yo, this not, you know, giving people jobs. This not, you know, giving the youth skills. This isn't mm-hmm. teaching people about what's going on because everybody here knows what's going on, right? So it's like preaching at a choir, for real. So, you know, that's when I took it upon myself and I was like, all right, cool. You know what? I'm a really, you know, solely focus on creative writing and literacy and trying to get students and, you know, particularly students, but, you know, trying to get everybody to read and become critical thinkers and to teach them the skill of creative writing and spoken word, because I know that that can help build communities and it also can help build the world. So that's my form of, like, you know, protest and activism, you know, in this world that we live in when we can't really just change policy how we want, you know. From the Andy Jones era, when homicides was high. Every night you hear a group of bullets flying through the sky. West side be getting money, but it's different on my side. It's 14 already trying to ride. Even when they go to school, they got the pistol by their side. Lord, how is gonna be ready when the enemy collides? Collect phone calls daily coming from the...
Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans proudly supports the Undisclosed podcast. Selecting a mortgage lender is a big decision, so it's important that when you make that decision, you go with someone you trust. Someone who has your best interest in mind. And with Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. You don't want to waste time that you probably don't have searching through stacks of paperwork. Rocket Mortgage modernizes that process. You can securely share your financial info to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. Whatever you're going to do, whether that's buying a new home or refinancing your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. You're going to skip the bank, you're going to skip the waiting, and you're going to do it completely online at quickenloans.com/undisclosed. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans is an equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
So, Justine, you spoke about his bats trying to apply some of the things that happened on the West Coast to the East Coast, right? Selling drugs and balloons, something that's not common that I've rarely saw, you know, ever. And then also, like, gang violence. Let's talk about that fake Bloods and Crips report, because when I saw that, I thought that was hilarious. Even one of the things I saw on the news around that time about a fake gang truce, I knew one of the dudes, and I know he, at the time, I knew he worked at Best Buy. So let's talk about that.
Okay, before I talk about that, there's something I want to say, which is that there's been this surprising experience for me, which is how many Baltimore police officers, current and retired, at all levels, going way up the chain, have been really, really open and supportive off the record. And some of the first things they say to me, and that's where I got this information about the various ways that Bats was lying and that people could tell that he wasn't, you know, right. Some of the first stuff they said to me was along the lines of that what happened to Freddie Gray wasn't right. They didn't support it. They also don't like the charges. So those two aren't mutually exclusive. And Commissioner Bats, they weren't happy with his leadership around it, and they weren't happy with Lieutenant Rice's behavior. And they were able, some of these cops were able to piece together what happened with so much clarity, stuff that took us months to do. And I just wanted to say that because it's been surprising for me. And some of them left Baltimore policing around the time of Commissioner Bats because they couldn't handle him or they were driven out. So I just wanted to share that. Yeah, in terms of the gang report, I mean, I can't imagine that read true to anybody. I mean, it was the day of Freddie Gray's funeral. And he's saying that these gangs are threatening police. It was the same thinking that led to the riots on the 27th, right? With the, you know, reading a few silly things on social media about a purge. It's sort of this, that's thought if he created hysteria around gangs, it would sort of serve him in the way that Trump believes that if he creates these enemies, it will serve his leadership. But, you know, Bats really didn't have that kind of support to begin with. I don't know. What are your thoughts about all of that?
I thought it was funny. Like, I thought I was watching like an episode of the Chappelle Show with these fake gang members jumping in front of the camera, you know, talking about it's going to be a truce, or the fake report about how gangs are going to unite to take out cops. Like, that's not true. People from Baltimore City understand that Baltimore City is a city of neighborhoods. You know, does organized crime exist here? Yeah, sure. It exists in every city. But Baltimore doesn't subscribe to the same type of code as a place like Los Angeles. Like, it's not, they can't be compared. In Los Angeles, a dude's life might be spared because he's like a triple OG. You know, he might be like a 30, 40-year-old gang member that, you know, has been banging, you know, since the 80s. And a kid might say, well, you know, you can't touch him because he put in a lot of work. Whereas in Baltimore City, nobody cares. A 7-year-old, 10-year-old person, given the right circumstances, will blow a 40-year-old person head off. It's one-on-one basketball. There's no team. Yeah, gang violence does exist, especially inside of the jails. But again, once you come home, I know dudes that get locked up and, you know, they're not affiliated with nothing. They come home BGF. But as soon as they come back home, they BGF for like 2 months. Then they out here trying to survive. You know, I know dudes that get locked up and turn into Muslims. And then they come home and they get with their moms and they Christians. You know what I'm saying? They come back home. They're like, yo, I've been home for 3 days, dog. Where's the bacon? You know what I'm saying?
They forget their supreme mathematics.
Yeah, they, you know, so, and I'm saying that, like, the city is so, like, it's not a city. And Baltimore has a history of resisting certain structures. But the British call us a little den of thieves. And you know, it's never been like that strong organized element. So even when he was talking, and I was like, yo, how can you have this job and you don't even know what you're talking about? But he also got the job, like you said, Justine, and he had his work history was already kind of questionable.
And even if you know Baltimore streets and you know the history of the people, like, people not dumb. They know they don't have more firearm than the police. I talked to a lot of dudes and I never heard nobody say anything about murdering the police because they know what's going to happen.
Or making a plan.
They're thrown under the jail.
How many people from Baltimore, you know, are going to say, yo, let's just make a strategic plan and take out, I got a whiteboard, I got some dry erase markers.
But it even show you, even from the false report that there was this big group and organizations like Bloods and Crips, whatever else, it shows you the disconnect. These, you know, quote unquote gangs that got credit for this credible threat actually had no influence in the community. And it just goes to show people in position, the power at B here, the power structure system here always gives credit to organizations that have no type of influence in the communities, whether it be Nation of Islam, whether it be whatever gangs that they said were here that actually, you know, might not actually be that prominent here. You know, they got credit for things that they had no, you know.
But look how stupid those reports were. Like, come on, dog. Millions of dollars of prescription drugs stolen. So you telling
like
me
that book.
You can run inside of a burning store and run right past the diabetes medicine and the herpes cream, and you find all the oxys and Percocets and then create some type of empire. How dumb does that sound? It don't sound stupid.
Definitely sounds stupid. Definitely nobody that hear about it. Nobody. Like, I asked a 43-year-old person that's still in the streets, and I asked a 17-year-old who's still in the streets, and nobody heard of that. Ever.
Yeah.
What I seen was people stealing applesauce and diapers. Like, I ain't seen nobody just walk out with a handful of pills. I saw people stealing things for survival.
Come on, though. Like, so is that even possible?
I don't know why that CVS would have.
You said, Justin, the FBI said something about that's not really, like, that wasn't really, like, a credible statement, or?
Yeah, I have a couple of sources that confirmed that. And, you know, they went after the Pill City book, too. What's interesting is that Batts did the same thing with the rank-and-file police officers. He said that they had kind of had this organized resistance against him and took a knee. So you have to think about how realistic is that too. I mean, when you think about cops trying to keep their jobs, are they all communicating with each other from all these different districts and divisions and saying, let's, you know, things don't work that way. And actually, there's a lot of parallels. You know, I heard an interesting story about the way somebody who worked in gang intelligence, organized crime division, talked about the way gangs operate in Baltimore and drugs are actually dealt and this sort of looseness and lack of organization. And I said to him, you know, it sounds a lot like the way policing operates in Baltimore. And he agreed with me. And I see a lot of parallels between the way policing operates in Baltimore and the way crime operates in Baltimore. I just thought that was interesting.
It's so crazy that, you know, like I said, like you guys said on the episode, how did this person even, how was he able to slick himself into this job? Like, it's beyond me. It's like, I'm starting to think I aim too low in life. Like, maybe I should, you know, Trump is president and Batts got to be commissioner. Maybe I should, you know, get a little 2020 campaign going on.
That's a question I have for a lot of people in Baltimore. So I want to ask this to you guys, because I think the media is so important here. When Batts was named commissioner, did you have any inkling whatsoever about his very disturbing past?
To be honest,
it's kind of Duane speaking.
I didn't know anything about this guy. I'm telling you, like, you know, it's only a small amount of people in Baltimore who are in tune to these things. And I'm telling you, like, I still live in East Baltimore, and I had conversations with my family and my friends that live there. And the things that we know about politics and policing, the average person doesn't know. I'm telling you, like, I didn't know Batts. I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know anything he did. It's just like, they're the police and we are, you know, who we are, and that's it. And we don't like each other. Like, that's it for real, you know. And that's not every black person in Baltimore or every, you know, black experience when it comes to, you know, knowing who the commissioner is and knowing who these people are. But I can speak for myself and the people who I'm around in East Baltimore.
I didn't know who Batts was. I mean, most people don't know. Like, most people can't tell you who their city councilman is, or let alone the police. Well, the only thing I knew about the police commissioner was that we had like six in the span of like 15 years, and most of them got fired and was suing the city. Up until the uprising, I ain't know Batts. I didn't know what he did. I just, you know, when he talked, he sounded like an idiot. So I don't know how he was qualified for the job or anything. And matter of fact, wasn't he the police commissioner when Oscar Grant happened?
Oscar Grant in Oakland.
No, you know what? I think he started exactly after that.
Yeah, I mean, but it's still like a history. Like,
but did they hire him as a reaction to that? Or,
well, he did mention that in his application, and also that he felt bad about the cops who had been shot in Oakland. So he played both sides in that way. It's funny that you say he was an idiot when he was talking. Well, I'm paraphrasing you, but I feel that too. I feel like, what is this person talking about? But he's described over and over again as well-spoken.
And he speaks so well.
And especially those articles with Fenton, you know, just glowing praise from the academics and from his friends and supporters, the Justin Fenton articles and Justin George.
Why do you think they liked him so much?
Well, I'll tell you my honest opinion as somebody who's been now sort of reporting access. Like, it's very intoxicating when powerful people confide in you and share with you. And that's my opinion. I don't know for a fact, but they got a lot of access to people, and they got scoops, you know, about this person who said, you know, I'll tell you all about my life and my background.
No, I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to like the Baltimore Sun reporting, like, I think Justin Fenton's probably one of the most whitest reporters like the city has ever seen. And, you know, him, like a lot of other white reporters in this town, in this city, he doesn't even understand the difference between, like, he sees this well-spoken, his version of well-spoken is a black man who stands up and talks articulately, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's any substance to that, to him talking. So he's not threatened by Anthony Batts because his position doesn't directly critique his place as a white person. But you even look at the reportage of the Baltimore Sun during the uprising, it was like, historically, the Baltimore Sun has been a racist newspaper, and their coverage of the uprising, their coverage of these black figures who were speaking, was so passive. It was so like, oh, we got these good Negroes that are talking. You know, it was just like historically re-entrenching the same thing that we've all been, you know, experiencing from, like, the, you know, the disenfranchisement from the media, or like not having representation. So like the community can actually speak up and be like, we don't know what you're talking about, but you're not talking for us.
I wasn't writing for the Baltimore Sun during the uprise, but like after it, I did a column with them because I felt like, you know, like just a different voice needed to be there. And when I tell you, I never got so many fuck you, D. Watkins, I hate you emails just from articles like, yo, here's how to stop the next Freddie Gray. Like, let's create opportunity instead of trying to demonize and subscribe to this further dehumanization. Like, let's figure out, you know, if Freddie Gray was alive, would you help him with a resume? You know, you can walk around with T-shirts and shit after he's dead, but when he was alive, what would you do to help this man be able to get out into society and have some opportunities? And people got mad at that. They got so mad at that. And I'm like, yo, I'm not, this isn't, you know, the New York Post or something like that. This is the Baltimore Sun. This is a newspaper in a 64 whatever percent black city. with a huge readership that stretches outside of Baltimore. But people was, they got mad at me. I was like,
they don't got one. They don't got no black authors on staff that actually come from the community and represent it. I mean, Erica left. She was probably the best one. But even Justin George is like this black writer in this white institution. That's like,
Justin George is gone too.
Oh, he is? Well, now yeah. Who did they have? Like, if think about it. If they weren't talking about
I
negative,
think Justin George got a job somewhere else. I'm not sure.
Fenton only talks about black crime. That's the only, that's like his porn for him. Like he gets off writing about like niggas killing each other or stuff like, you know, they, so they don't talk about any positive aspects or even try to employ any black people so that they can write, you know, and talk about what's actually happening or be able to interpret why the outside world don't see why the people in these communities move this type of way.
It's Baltimore Sun, people, if you're listening, there's some black writers out here that need some jobs. We know Erica's gone and we know a couple of other people left. Maybe, you know, what they say for, what was the quote Justine about for when they hire bats looking for a black guy? How'd it go?
I mean, the thing is that in Baltimore, the other person up for the job was also African-American. That was Barksdale. So it wasn't really about that, although certainly they were going to bring in somebody African-American if they weren't going to hire Barksdale. But it wasn't as much that. You know, I'll tell you something that I hear a lot. When people would say, like, why, how in the world would somebody with that track record, like losing millions of dollars for the city of Long Beach because he was, you know, retaliatory covering up for the lobster gate, and then not even fulfilling 3 years in Oakland, cutting out after 1.5, you know, trying to leave. How did he get a job in Baltimore? And a lot of people say he charmed the mayor, you know? In fact, everybody says that. And I get it. Like, I get how that works.
So do you think, from the outside looking in, do you think Barksdale was a better fit for the job than Bats?
I'll tell you, the rank and file think so. And I think that that matters. Like, I think it's very hard to run an effective police department that has any level of accountability if the police officers themselves have no respect for their leaders. He came from a era that had somewhat more integrity in terms of reducing uses of force. See, that was sort of the thing with Anthony Batts. The thinking was, you know, this is the era now. This is the first time in policing history when uses of force, like incidents, are being counted as an outcome alongside crime statistics. Do you see what I mean? And that was the language that Batts spoke. I think that Barksdale would have been better, yeah. You know, I don't know if he would have been exactly right, but I don't know if there is exactly right.
Where was Barksdale from?
West Baltimore.
Baltimore, yeah.
Oh, he was actually from Baltimore.
Yeah.
Because I think that's another thing. Like, you know, like we even, if you look at what's wrong with Baltimore City Policing, you know, none of these officers, for the most part, the majority of these officers don't actually come from the city.
Yeah.
So they don't understand the culture. And I don't know when's the last time we actually had a police commissioner who like came up through the ranks and files of Baltimore City Police. And not saying that that's better, you know, that that's a good thing, but like somebody who actually would understand the culture of like the people here to like implement policies that wouldn't harm us.
Shouldn't that matter?
And it should, because my cousin, his older sister is a police officer and she from Baltimore, and she is stationed in, you know, the West Baltimore area. And she say that she have co-workers, I guess that's what you want to call them or whatever, and they'll see certain situations going on and they won't know how to handle it because they don't know what's going on. Like if they see two people yelling, they don't know that's how we talk to each other, so they think a fight about to break out, so they like got their hand on their taser, right? So she was just basically talking about the importance of knowing where you are. It's just like in Cuba, you know, when somebody telling you to come here, they hold their hand up like they giving you a five and bring their fingers forward, opposed to us doing this, right? So it's like just knowing where you are, knowing.
Why are you sending people and hiring leaders that don't understand the culture?
Is it
because you want to have people with no connection that way they can like maybe
break somebody,
have no compassion for the situations?
I think it's about who like really run the city and who those individuals are more comfortable with, right? Like the commissioner isn't here to serve the community as much as he's here to serve the interest and the investments that happen in this community. So if you got somebody that can sit at the table, and those individuals like Kevin Plank and Brown and all these other developers in the city where they're investing all this money, like, are you protecting our investment in this city? I think that that plays a big part in it too, where if you have somebody that reflected at a community saying like, I'm not sending resources to the Inner Harbor or the Harbor East, I'm gonna send my resources to like these neighborhoods that really need community engagement. You know, I think that would go against what the plan had be for the developers that really run the city.
I guess the bigger question is, how do we get to a place where a police commissioner can look at the city and say, you know, us, this is all about us versus having this us, this is them type of thing.
I don't believe that person will ever exist, because like you said a few weeks ago when we was in D.C., you said the system is bad, right? It's a horrible system. And the guys like that probably really do want to get in and, you know, make change, they probably don't make it to that position, or they might get that and not be that long enough to really implement change. Because you say you get rewards for being quote unquote tough on crime. You get awards for breaking people back and for locking up people for no reason, right? That's their thing. Like, that's how they get off. So I don't believe, and I might, you know, sound crazy, or, you know, I might sound like a, you know, a person who's just always, you know, looking negative at situations, but I'm just being real. I feel like that's not a place where that we need to be seeking change. I believe that the things that we doing now in the communities are the real ways, like trying to, you know, decide, oh, do we want Bats or do we want Boxdale or do we want Keisha or do we want Ebony? Like, I feel like none of those things gonna matter because the whole system is bad.
You know, you said something that, like, I've had a lot of conversations with older people, whether it be in positions of power in the community, they'd be like, yo, y'all generation is so negative. All y'all do is talk about what's wrong. And like, yo, we supposed to. I'm 22, you 23, 24. Like, we supposed to be, like, for us to be this age, and that was the beauty about the uprising, it was all young people. For us to be this conscious and this thoughtful at 22, 23, and it'd be like, yo, this is wrong. These policies are wrong. This program is not really resourceful or helpful. Like, we're supposed to do that. And what leadership here in the city won't do is empower young people.
Because a lot of people, they don't want to flip the table over and shake things up. They want a seat at the table. And then once they get a seat at the table, then it's like, you know what?
Yeah,
young people, you need to fall back and fall in line and go to church and pull your pants up and all
and
that.
And I'm telling you, a perfect example is, like, if something wrong, I'm going to say that it's wrong. I don't care who is going to affect. Malcolm X got a quote, and this isn't verbatim, but he said, you know, if you stick a knife in somebody's back 10 inches and you pull it out 2 inches, that's not progress. I don't care what nobody say. It's not progress. So we supposed to be okay with, oh, you know, we lock up 30,000 black people and now we free 5. Y'all should be happy now. You didn't see Obama go to these jails and, you know, be the only president who went, like, so what?
How many gonna ride for me? How many gonna die for me? How many gonna ride for me? How many gonna die for me?
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
So one of the hosts of this podcast is a new mother. It's not me, obviously, but it is Rabia Chaudhry. Our listeners who know about how much Rabia does might sometimes wonder, how does she do it? She's got 2 podcasts to host, she's written a best-selling book, she manages a day job, and yet somehow she is raising a newborn infant. That's pretty special, and Rabia deserves to feel special, especially this Mother's Day. Do you want to know what her husband Irfan is doing to make her feel special? He is going to hook her up with some delicious Sherry's Berries. That's right, Mother's Day is coming up, and Sherry's Berries is offering freshly dipped delicious berries starting at $19.99 plus shipping. And right now, I have an exclusive offer for you. When you double the berries for your mom for just $10 more, she will get free cake truffles too. That's like a whole extra gift for free. Pick your delivery date, and Sherry's Berries will guarantee you that your delivery will arrive fresh and delicious or your money back. I am not ashamed to admit that I got some Sherry's Berries recently and they were amazing. It's like getting these gourmet chocolate-covered delicious berries delivered right to me like a chef had just made them. So do something special for your mom this Mother's Day. Get her Shari's Berries. The only way to get this amazing berries deal starting at $19.99 is to visit berries.com. Click on the microphone at the top right corner of the page and use undisclosed promo code UA. That's BERRIES.com. Promo code UA when you click on the mic. This amazing Mother's Day deal will not last long. And Mother's Day is right around the corner, so be sure to order now. That's Shari's Berries at berries.com.
Let's go back and let's loop back around to this whole idea of what a police officer says. It's maybe I'm not, you know, I don't know if this is true or not, but maybe it's a cop out here who's listening, who's saying, you know what? Kandwani Fidel makes a lot of sense, and Kwame Rose, he's making some good points, and everything that Justine reported and said is verifiable, and it makes a lot of sense. But then you have a guy like Joey Crystal. That's his name, right, Justine? Joe Crystal?
Joe mm-hmm. Crystal, yeah.
Yeah, you have a guy like Joe Crystal who tried to get out there and tried to do some things that was right, and his life was kind of ruined, right?
Yeah. So the problem as it stands is that Joe Crystal's not the only one. He was the most outspoken, but a lot of them are seeing what's wrong. And the system is set up right now in Baltimore where if you speak up, you should be afraid to speak up against what doesn't look right. Whereas what needs to happen is sort of this radical undoing of all of that and a complete shift so that it should be that you're afraid to not speak up. And we're going to talk about this more next week in the episode, but they did that in New York and under one commissioner, which was if you saw somebody next to you committing misconduct, if you don't speak up, you're implicated too. So that's the complete opposite of what Joe Crystal went through. And so that's what would need to happen. I think that, you know, somebody said something before about how there hasn't been any commissioners from Baltimore, and that wasn't entirely true. The commissioner before Batts, Bielfeld, was from Baltimore. He was white, though, and he and the state's attorney at the time, there was sort of this appearance of them not quite getting it or cronyism. And I think we have to look past a lot of these false binaries that sort of structure our debates. Are they from here or are they not from here? Are they pro-community or are they pro-police? I think it's just everybody has to think past that and look for really underlying structures and systems. And the biggest one for me is accountability. How is it actually happening and how is it actually being enforced? Cops are by nature followers and they're by nature scared. And if they are, instead of being scared of the community and following other bad cops, they're scared of doing wrong, that could be a radical transformation. It would be at least a step in the right direction. Does that make sense?
True. And with me, I don't necessarily care if somebody's from Baltimore or not, because I can go to a different state tomorrow and connect with people. I believe that some of these people, like Dee said, they're not connected. So that's why it's okay to treat people the way that they treat them, because if it happens to that, they wouldn't treat their mother like that. They wouldn't treat their son like that, their daughter like that. But they don't mind treating someone else like that. So that's what I believe. It doesn't matter where you're from. You can be from California, you could be from North Dakota, or you could be from Baltimore. If you understand and you respect everybody as humans and you view everybody as humans, like, come on, like, everybody know that the war on drugs was a scam. Everybody know that these ideas and these policies are scams. And it's a scam to keep black people padlocked to poverty. Everybody knows that. It's statistics, scientists, they show it, lawyers present it in their court cases. We watch documentaries and networks that literally show you black people getting murdered and brutalized by police officers and by systemic oppression. We see the schools, we see the students. So it's like presenting facts won't solve anything, right? These people just have to view us as human.
You know, what was interesting was, like, being at the uprising and now that the Jordan Peele movies come out, what you saw, a lot of the black police officers that were in riot gear, when they saw the people like crying in front of them, it was like kind of they were like having that moment where, what was the maid name in Get Out, where she was like trying to break out of the sunken place. Like, I seen a lot of black women that were police officers in riot gear with tears running down their face, you know, the whole entire time. And like, what has to happen when we talk about changing the culture of policing in Baltimore is that For one, the FOP in Baltimore, the Fraternal Order of Policing Lodge number 3, is the most racist and powerful FOP that exists in this country. Gene Ryan is a like explicit racist. And what happens is that no black people in positions of power will speak up and call him out for what it actually is. You know, the policing and the institutions in this city have like made black people in positions of power fearful of calling racism for what it is. We've seen it in the mayor's campaign where they were literally promoting ads that said it's been enough talk about racism and white supremacy when it hasn't. This is a 63% black population city. There's 70% of the police officers that are white. There is no black vanguard that is mandatory to like represent the black police officers, because if you talk to most black police officers, they have a problem with the way the department has been running for decades. They just don't have a voice or an avenue that will support them and represent them. Or a union that like
so who's gonna jump? Who's gonna jump out there?
Man, I think it's like people in positions of power. We got a black state.
Because most black cops I know that wanted to act like they care. They play the 50.
They do.
To the viewer, I mean to the listeners who don't know what playing a 50 means. This is a quick little
Baltimore lesson.
Real quick. You say what you need to say to make the community smile, and then you say what you need to say to make your fellow police officer smile. You plan to 50.
Yeah, but no, I think it's like people just scared to like, we'll witness the truth, but then people in position of power are so scared to just admit it. It's like they try to rewrite it in their head.
Or a perfect example, like the whole idea, you wrote the essay about your own personal experience relating to Get Out, right? So this is just, you know, just throwing this idea out there. This might be the thing. You know, you grow up and you wanted to be a police officer since you were a child, right? Like you just wanted to be a hero, whatever, you know, police officer stuff. That's what you wanted to do. And you get there and you realize that it's really bad, right? And now you contemplating, yo, do I, perfect example is training day. Right. The white dude, he could have easily stayed, got so much money, could have been crooked, but he wasn't with it. Right. And he just took a different route. But how many people really take that different route when your girl having a second baby? Right. Y'all living in a little apartment and, you know, you can be crooked and murder people and throw people in jail and get raises and get all of this money, you know, under wraps.
There's no incentive to do the right thing.
Right, so it's like, how many people are really gonna get out?
And most of the black cops are trying to survive as well. To them, it's a job. They're trying to survive. If they speak out, they know there'll never be another. Look at what happened to Joy Crystal. Joy Crystal's experience has been far different than what Michael Wood's experience has been. Joy Crystal now, who like really loved serving the community and being a good cop, he like now is stuck in some small police department like in the South somewhere where like, you know, he literally was silenced. Whereas though you have, if a white person speaks out about these things, they rewarded with riches and they rewarded with attention. And it's like validating to hear a white person explain it. But when a black person who's really just trying to survive and be that impactfulness, they get shitted on and thrown to like the garbage bin from where they already came. And it's like, you know, their efforts to try to change policing have now like deterred any other black people from ever wanting to be a good cop.
I think that all of this is really important for people who are interested in kind of understanding what really happened to Freddie Gray and how it could have happened. Is that one of the questions a lot of people had are, how could these 6 officers not do anything seeing him in trouble? First of all, it's not 6. We know that there were many cops there that day, and there was one, you know, Officer Novak who played a huge role. But we have to put it in the context of, you know, possibly people in charge not behaving properly. And what are very, very young patrol officers, younger than you guys, in some cases, supposed to do in that situation, knowing what happened to somebody like Joe Crystal? And when we talk about what choices do they have, you know, a lot of them left the department. And so that's why the numbers are so low, because it's not true that all of them just go crooked to survive. And I don't think any of you said that at all. It's just a lot of people leave. I mean, I've left crooked jobs myself. You know, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah. And I also believe that there's a stigma, like you asked, you know, about like how this relates to Freddie Gray. Right. It's a stigma that's on black culture, that's on our roots. Right. I grew up in Baltimore. Right. I'm subscribing to my culture, right? I wear these type of jeans and I wear a gold chain and I put golds in my mouth. All I'm doing is just embracing my culture, how everyone else is embracing theirs across the world. But mine is demonized by society. Mine is criminalized, right? So all I'm doing is subscribing to my culture. I was just at Virginia State a couple days ago, and I was in this theory class, and the professor had pulled two random people out of the class, and one of the dudes had dreadlocks. He had a gold chain. He had golds in his mouth. He had tight jeans. He had Jordans. And the professor asked the black girl about his dress and said, when you look at him, what do you see? She said, somebody who probably not going to go find life, who probably not going to get a job, who probably this, who probably that. So she was like, so how can he change that? And she said, I don't know, maybe take his locks out, take his chain off. So then she started saying like how she was subscribing to this certain mentality. But then she said, you know, okay, you're thinking this way and basically having a conformist mindset, right? So then she say, okay, say he wants to keep that, right? How can you change the perception of who he is? And she just keeps saying he got to take it off. Like, she not saying, oh, let's change the meaning behind his roots and his culture and the things that he wear. She just keeps saying that he got to take it off, right? So that shows the type of image that she sees, you know, when she see a black man. And this guy had the best grade in the class. That's what topped everything off. So you have people, black people too, who view, you know, black people that dress a certain way, that speak a certain way, they view them as inferior, and they view them as A, you know, not going far in life, or B, being a thug, you know, just like a Freddie Gray, or just like it could be me, Kwame, or D, any given day walking these streets in Baltimore City.
Be getting wicked on my side of town. Since the early 80s, it's been going down. Hitting blocks with the guns that make the helicopter sound. Homicide detective chalking up 150 rounds.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Not a week goes by in my life where, even today, as a 40-something-year-old wife, mother, professional, that I don't get a call from my mom saying that she saw something, read something, learned something that could benefit me. Now it's a vitamin I should take, a book I should read, a prayer she thinks would be helpful for me. And I realize that in my life, no one has done that for me other than my mom. And I'm sure there are many things like that you think about when you think about your mother, that no one in your life has had the same impact or cares about you in the same way as your mom. And those of us who are moms know that, yeah, it's a thankless job, and the smart ones appreciate their moms before they become mothers themselves, but it did take motherhood for me to get it. Well, this Mother's Day is a chance to show your appreciation. And when you send the 100 Blooms for Mom bouquet from Pro Flowers this Mother's Day, you're going to make a real impression, and you're going to tell her how much you appreciate her. That's 100 Blooms. It comes with a free glass vase for just $19.99 plus shipping and handling. And if you really want to make a statement and you know she's got a sweet tooth, you can upgrade to a premium vase and include gourmet chocolates for just $10 more. You can choose the delivery date you want, and Pro Flowers are guaranteed to arrive fresh and beautiful, and they stay that way for at least 7 days or you get your money back. The bouquet I received from Pearl Flowers was gorgeous, sumptuous, colorful, and just full of abundance and love. I always try to keep fresh flowers in my house. Moms love fresh flowers, and Pro Flower makes it easy to send the perfect Mother's Day gift this year with this huge, beautiful bouquet. So don't forget all the moms in your life. I'm talking about your mom, your grandma, your aunt, your wife, and whoever else you consider a mother figure this Mother's Day. The only way to get 100 blooms for mom with a free glass vase starting at $19.99 is to visit proflowers.com. You click on the microphone in the top right corner and you use my code UA. That's proflowers.com, and the code is UA when you click on the mic. This stunning bouquet sells out fast, so order today.
You know, the last episode was about surveillance, and I think part of the problem is, you know, I've heard cops tell me that there's a real us versus them mentality in policing. And I've heard this outside of Baltimore, too, that it's described kind of as like storming the battlegrounds. And, you know, that mentality, that shift is going to be really important. And so if your life is involved in surveying a neighborhood, just sitting on corners, watching, waiting for things to happen, thinking that you can take on the enemy by just being there and watching everybody, then these stereotypes are going to get reinforced, as opposed to seeing yourself, as they say, as a guardian, as a protector of that neighborhood and all of the people in it.
Oh, that sounds so alien. Like, the word guardian used in context of a cop is just like, me no hablo.
It is us versus them. Like, the history of policing, and the first like police forces were slave patrols. So it is us versus them. Like, you can be standing outside and the police ride past and it changed the whole mood. Nobody had nothing on them. And the police, just because they have the power and authority to fuck with you, they will.
It's also covered in an episode, you know, just the history of black police officers and how at the time they didn't even have the power to lock up a white person. It's like, you better call your white friends.
So who created that us versus them? Definitely not us. We didn't create it.
No, we don't have the power.
We don't. Exactly. They created it. We're just living in it.
It's them versus us.
It's like, the war on drugs that created it, but not entirely, but it reinforced it to such a huge
degree. Well, no, we were scared of the police before the war on drugs, though. Like, you look at the civil rights movement, that was before the war on drugs.
Yeah.
You know, you had dogs being sent on black people just for walking. Like, it's been a history, yeah. Right? We can mask it with whatever, like, program that the federal government rolls out every 20, 30 years. But no, in reality, police forces and their dogs have always been trained to kill black people, harm black people, and see us as inferior. And our reaction to that, for every action there's a reaction. Our reaction from the racist actions of police institutions and forces in this country is a validatable feeling, because literally we have been dying by the hands of white slave patrols and police officers in this country since we've been running away trying to say, like, I'm a human being. And that's since we've been on this shores.
Well, now a lot of us think it's our own fault. We think it's our fault. So we actually think that the way we're treated is based on our actions.
Yeah, and it's crazy, because
that's the most powerful tool of the oppressor.
And I used to always say that. And I used to always say that when I was growing up. I used to always think that it was something wrong with black people. I used to say it all the time. Yo, niggas just be tripping, or they be wilding, right? But then you got the Carter G. Wilson quote. He say, in order to control a man's action, you control his thinking, right? So, and if he say, you know, if it's not a back door, then he gonna carve one for himself, right? So it's like we automatically subscribe to these, you know, back doors, you know, in these places of inferiority, because that's where we're driven to, you know, through us being mind control, you know, like even the idea, like you were speaking about, like on Kendrick Lamar's song Fair, he was like, I beat your ass if you tell him social workers he live here.
Yeah.
Right? So that's,
yo,
like,
that's
so
that's, you can so really like, beat your
so
ass.
That's like, so that's like, that's like a fear, because if this child let the social workers know that somebody else is standing in this house when it's only
father,
supposed to be when
the
it's
father.
Only, when it's only supposed to be this amount of people
that
here.
Check ain't coming.
And no
that
father.
Check ain't coming. That's control right there. You ain't got to put your hands on nobody.
But that's a training, right? You have to train your child to lie to these government forces. Like, I think with black people as a community, what we do have to do is become more self-sustainable and strategic, right? Like, there is no reason why, like, how everybody growing up had to have that talk about what happens when you, like, when you first start driving, what happens when you get pulled over by the police.
But I feel like saying that we need to be more strategic is the same, is,
yo,
the same ideology.
Old? Am I too old? Because I never had that talk with nobody. Like, when I was born.
Man, I went to senior week, man, Ocean City. My father said, look, the cops going to pull you over because you black.
Yo, as soon as I came out of elementary school, I knew what time it was. I already knew. So by the time I started driving, I remember when I got my first Acura, like my first luxury car, I was in high school. I used to take my license to the window because I got pulled over so much. I used to take it to the window. It was a joke to me, but it was like funny to the police officers who would pull me over because I got stopped
but
so
I think
much.
Now, it's more fearful because we've seen so many police stops, like on video on social media, where people have like actually died. But like now I think, yo, like I don't think it's anything wrong with telling young black boys, especially, like, yo, you don't get to play with a toy gun.
And that's cool to, you know, do these things, but then it becomes hard because then when you see that child with the fake gun who probably didn't get that talk and he gets murdered, then you're gonna have people that say, oh, he should have known better. So at the end of the day, I still believe that thinking, you know, we have to do more of this in order for them to stop that. I feel like that's like blaming a victim instead of victimizer.
We're not blaming victims.
All of my friends that grew up to be murderers, they don't matter if they play. Some of my friends who played with toy guns grew up to be Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah.
Some of my friends.
Well, I'm talking about in an effort to prevent their lives being taken.
Some of my friends who grew up with toy guns grew up to sell Amway and fake. What's that they trying to sell you with the video phones? The pyramid schemes. And then some of my friends who wanted to play basketball and wanted to like tell us not to smoke weed and stuff, they grew up to blow your head off. So it's like,
I'm saying, like, you know, that was just an example, right? But we have to, like, as a community, we got to take it amongst ourselves to educate our young people on more preventative measures. Because no matter what, when you're thrown out into that real world, if you don't prevent a situation from happening, we'll always be reacting.
So what about those people, right, who try their best to prevent it and they still end up, you know, in these situations? Like I wrote about in my book, the dude, Jonathan Fleming, he was in Florida, right, chilling at Disney World. Mm-hmm. And he got arrested and did over 20 years in prison for murdering his friend. Mm-hmm. Until the 20, and mind you, he had plane tickets, photos, videos, everything, right? So like that 24th, 23rd year, they say, oh, he was, you know, in Florida the day before the murder even happened, right? So it's like he did everything, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's kind of criminal to put anything on the people when, like you just said, you know, it's them against us. They created that. Mm-hmm. Right. So we can do all of the right things. I got arrested like 3 times when I was younger for just walking the street, for loitering, you know, for spitting on the ground, things that I didn't know. So it's like, and I was going, you know, I was going to school, getting good grades. You know, I'm on a basketball team. I'm doing everything that I believe that I should be doing. But somehow, some way, they found a way to put me in the system. Right.
Well, we try to put truth first here so the listeners should know he's not actually not that good at basketball. I'm sorry, but go ahead. I don't want to.
I mean, there's this 140. There's this
40.
I think this conversation that you guys are having is incredibly uncomfortable for the white majority. And I think it's probably uncomfortable for a lot of African Americans, too. Nobody wants to think about, especially in the United States, where we have these values of self-reliance, that some people are victims in a big way, and that there's sort of nothing some people can do. I mean, as a woman, I can relate. You know, women can do everything right and still be raped, and we're told, well, maybe don't wear this or don't wear that, and it won't happen, exactly. But it still will happen. You know, disabled right. Elderly women get raped, and I feel like these conversations are so important. They're just so deeply uncomfortable for people. It's uncomfortable on an individual level to wake up to the reality of historic and deep oppression, and it's uncomfortable socially. And I just feel like it's really important to be that uncomfortable, because there are no easy answers to this. You know, change your clothes.
Exactly. Like what? She shouldn't have been wearing that little skirt then. Oh, what does she have on? Like, what? That's not even a question.
Well, I think for white people who are uncomfortable, like, they have to realize, you're like, you know, black people have never, ever got to be comfortable in this country. Like, even if I look at, like, you know, since we are talking about Freddie Gray, like, the past 2 years since Freddie Gray has happened, so many young people have garnered platforms in Baltimore. But it wasn't, none of us, I don't think, are comfortable. It's all a constant grind and how we get to a level of comfortableness. But at the same time, we're still talking about uncomfortable topics. We're still talking about the uncomfortable experiences that led us around our perception of blackness and how we educate young people who are now watching go through those same uncomfortable experiences. Like, this shit is tragic for me to talk about every day. And so you should be uncomfortable because
talking about it, like, look, they get uncomfortable when we talk about it. We live in it every day. Yeah, it's like, come on, dog.
Why are you asking me why I got a 40 in my hand and why I'm just out smoking a blunt? Like, that's because I don't have a 40 in my hand. You looked at my hand. No, but no, I'm saying, like, yo, like, this, like, our everyday lived experience is the uncomfort that you are experiencing when we talk about it. But you'd rather not us talk about it? Like, no, that's like, we're trying to better ourselves and better the people that come after us. So when we have these conversations, it's not to make anybody feel, well, it is to make you feel uncomfortable, because like, we felt it and internalized that uncomfortableness to a form of complacency, and which will only re-entrench the cycle. And then 20 years from now, you'll have a small group of people talking about the same uncomfort, as opposed to having a generation build a level of comfort and safety that will protect us.
And if our truths, you know, make you uncomfortable, then you just got to deal with that, because We just telling the truth. We're going to continue to tell the truth, and we're going to continue to get these books to schools. We're going to continue to talk to these people in these communities, and we're going to continue to do the work that needs to be done, the real work. So, I mean, and if that makes you uncomfortable, then that says a lot about you, and you need to, you know, reevaluate yourself and redirect, you know, your thoughts.
And it ain't a lot of help neither.
All right, so let's go with takeaways from Kwame to Kandwani to Justine. Just solutions are moving forward. Kwame?
You know, I think solutions moving forward is like to have these conversations and you know, that are uncomfortable. I've spoken on a lot of college campuses in the last 2 years and just talking to young people and being like, yo, if you got a white friend, call your white friend out and learn from each other's cultural experiences. So I think once we talk more about the issues in which we face in our lived experiences, we all can start to view the world differently through experiences. Another thing I say is continue to pressure your state, your elected officials to like actually become engaged and representative and reflections of the community. And number three, I think we all should continue to fight in for the justice of not just victims of police brutality, but, you know, all victims of racial justice and prejudices throughout the country.
Kandwani?
And I definitely agree. It's a constant battle, you know, that we're going to fight until we die, you know, if you choose that. But like I say, I'm just big on, you know, teaching the youth creative writing and poetry and, you know, trying to help and advance their critical thinking skills, you know, so they can, you know, make the right decisions and they can help their communities and they can help the world. And I feel like the best way to do that is through literacy, you know, which I do now. I visit high schools and I talk to students. I go to different communities. I talk to students. I have a real relationship with many students in different cities through social media, through the phone, through, you know, school visits. And, you know, I feel like I'm one person and this is my way that I give back. And I feel like, you know, for the people out there who have questions like, you know, how can I help? How can I help? We all have some kind of privilege and we all have some type of skill that we can pass on to somebody. So I believe that that's what we need to start doing as a people to, you know, create these infrastructures.
Justine?
I'm just so moved by everything you've said. I mean, just this idea of having to coexist with so much sort of personal and historic pain and also trying to better yourself by talking about the truth, I think is such an important takeaway. I would really like the media to be taking a hard, radical look at itself and to understand how bias works. I don't think that they're conscious of it yet. I'm sorry this isn't a more positive note to end on. It's just, it's something that I'm really starting to understand, that the media needs a better understanding of how its biases work, something we're going to talk about in a future episode.
Cool. And for me, you know, I would like to see Justin Fenton come on and have a conversation with Kwame Rose so he could talk about his work in Kwame and have like a real good conversation. I think
he won't have a beer with me.
I don't want to see you guys have a beer. I want to see you guys have a real conversation and then maybe have a beer like when I don't like beer.
But I'm down for
it. You know, this was great and, you know, another great conversation, and I'm really, really honored that I get the opportunity to talk to you guys. Let everyone know where we can find you guys at.
I'm on social media at Kwame Rose. You can look out for my weekly contributions to USA Today.
Everything is Kandwani Fidel. That's KONDWANIFIDEL. That's KandwaniFidel.com, Kandwani Fidel on Twitter and Instagram. You know, a lot of these things that I spoke about is in my book, Raw Wounds, and that's on Amazon. Just go to Amazon.com, type in Raw Wounds. Yeah.
And Justine, where can we find you?
At Justine3000.
I'm D. Watkins, and you can find me on all forms of social media at D. Watkins World. Fans, you can discuss the episode with the hashtag undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray. Tag questions for future addenda with the hashtag UDAddendum. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle at UndisclosedPOD. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Peace.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Thanks to Ryan and Ernesto for continuing to support us. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media produced The Addendum, along with super producer Methil Telhan. A big thanks to our sponsors, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, Sherry's Berries, and Pro Flowers. To our fans, thank you for supporting our sponsors. Great sponsorship makes for great podcasts. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music. The embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez, a Baltimore artist who lends his sounds to our show. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Undisclosed Pod. Lastly, and leastly, Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 10. Until then.
Love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.